KTFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999.
Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington. Welcome to this hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW Washington, 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, 47 years plus strong, going into our 48th year, because you, the listener, both new and regular, decide to support us with social connectivity and financial wherewithal. For that, I am extremely grateful. I'm making that remark, especially since we completed our fall fund drive, and I thank the listeners for their generosity. Those of you who still want to support the station can do so at WPFWFM.org. There's a bright red button that says donate in the upper left corner. The day after the national elections of 2024, here we are with a post-election roundup. Regardless of which candidate has gained office, there is much to explore with our recent national elections that go right down to our communities. To help us do that, we have some very, very able political scientists joining us today. Dr. Clarence Lussain is the professor of political science and the director of the International Affairs Program at Howard University. For more than 40 years and in more than 75 countries, he has written about, studied, and been active in national and international human rights, anti-racism politics, diaspora engagements, U.S. foreign policy, democracy building, and various social justice issues. Dr. Lussain is an international expert and observer with the European Commission Against Racism and Intolerance. Among his many books are The Black History of the White House, and his latest book, $20 and Change, Harry Tubman versus Andrew Jackson and the Future of American Democracy. Dr. Keisha Middlemoss is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. She teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in public policy and American politics. She studies the intersection of race, public policy, and marginalized populations, and uses ethnographic methodology, interviews, focus groups, and archival research to support her work. Dr. Middlemass focuses specifically on the questions about politics of punishment, racial justice, and the lived experiences of formerly incarcerated adults. Her book, Convicted and Condemned, The Politics and Policies of Prisoner Reentry, is an interdisciplinary and multi-layered examination of prisoner reentry. And Dr. Jasmine Carrera-Smith is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at George Washington University. Dr. Smith studies American politics with a focus on race, ethnicity, and politics. Her book project, Electability Politics, How and Why Black Americans Vote in Primary Elections, elucidates how Black Americans make vote choice decisions in primary elections, that is, their considerations regarding the electability of a particular candidate. Welcome to all of you. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And thanks for having us.
I like to say to our listeners to get started, I did the organizational affiliations, but they do not represent institutional positions. And that includes yours truly here at our Pacifica radio station. We're all speaking for ourselves, making observations by ourselves, but enabled by our own abilities, but also the communities we are accountable to. Also, I'd just like to start us all off with permitting some space for any immediate observations you would like to make. Let's start with Dr. Smith first.
Yeah, I think one of the immediate observations just this first day after the election is we had all of these questions going into the election about demographics. What groups are going to vote for which candidates, right? And so we have these questions about, you know, the stronghold of the Black community for the Democratic Party. And there were lots of questions about whether Black men were going to, subsets of Black men, right, were going to support Donald Trump and the Republican Party. And it's still new, right? And so we're still going to find out this information in the days and weeks to come. But it does look like there are some subsets of Black men, not a majority, right, but enough to help Donald Trump win in this election. There were also questions about the Latino vote, right? And how important that would be for Donald Trump and whether his recent comments about, let's say, Puerto Ricans or his stance on immigration would be enough to help Trump win. And we see county by county results that in places like Pennsylvania and Nevada and Arizona, these places that had enough of Latino voters that they went for Trump in ways that was more than in 2016 and more than in 2020. And then finally, I'll say there were questions about what women were going to do, particularly because reproductive rights were on the ballot, particularly for support. That's one of the main issues, you know, for the Harris campaign. And the real question was about white women, what white women were going to do, right? And it does seem just these early exit poll results are showing that white women also supported Donald Trump in ways that we've seen in the past in 2016 and 2020. So these questions about demographics are still going to be important, and we're going to learn more information about them as we continue on in the days and weeks to come. But I think that's one of the main takeaways that I'm getting this first day after the election.
And demographics being the kind of magic word, I know, Dr. Lusain, you head up a project at Howard University that speaks to polling and engagement. Can you I'll be just up front. We've talked over the last few weeks about the whole, what are Black men doing? How many are supporting Donald Trump?
Yeah, so I don't head up the Our polling group, I'm a part of it. It's
I'm
called
sorry.
the that's okay. The Howard University Initiative on Public Opinion, HIPPO is the acronym. So I definitely want to pick up from Dr. Smith and some of the critical points she raised, because what we saw in our polling was a lot of shifting. Early in the year, there had clearly been, and our polling had shown that support for Donald Trump was higher than what we thought it would you would on what you would think it would be. It was somewhere 15-20%, and for Black men, reflecting other polls, it was something like 20-25%. But that changed after Harris consolidated and became the nominee. We saw the numbers start to kind of go back, and our polls specifically focused on Black registered voters. But looking at the exit polls coming out of yesterday, what we see is something around 20% of Black men and about 12% of Black voters overall, which is higher than the 8% that Donald Trump won in 2000 and 2020. Just in terms of a general comment, I would open up the aperture a little bit and not just focus on Trump or Harris, but at trends in US politics. And one of the things that's been clarified is that the move in the US politics to the far right has cemented. The Biden-Harris interlude is starting to look more like it was an anomaly, because following Obama, you consistently saw from the Tea Party and onward, more and more of a far right emergence in mainstream politics. And what we saw last night was a harshening of that, not only in red states, but in blue states, in New York, in Virginia, they moved to the right. And part of it is a very racialized white nationalist framing. But we have to look beyond that, because we see a way in which African Americans, Hispanics, the numbers are about 45% supported Trump. So there's more going on than just the white nationalist great replacement fear. There's a winning of folks to an agenda that includes attacks on abortion, on women more generally, LGBTQ community, immigrants, Muslims, basically the whole far right playbook. And so we're going to have to grapple with that dynamic as it moves beyond just the white community.
Well, Dr. Middlemass, I want you to join us. Given what your colleagues have said, I just want to do one small punctuation. At the present count regarding the national presidential election, Vice President Harris gained about 66.7 million votes, and Donald Trump received 71.5 million votes. But first of all, your observations and whatever you might add at this point.
Thank you so much. I would like to start with, I am like most people this morning, still grappling with the outcome of the, not just the outcome of the election, but the demographic outcomes, where the red states are now redder, that Trump outperformed his 2020 election results. And want to also make clear that I believe Harris ran not a flawless, but a close to phenomenal election campaign in 107 days. So this is not, and I know the Democrats are going to do a autopsy on what she did or what she didn't do, but I want to make clear that this is not a Harris-Walz campaign fault. The outcome is not on them. They did everything correctly by the book, and maybe by the book needs to change. But the outcome of this election is a choice Americans made. And back to the demographics that Dr. Smith and Dr. Lussain just mentioned, is the overwhelming support from white women. There was conversation about the gender gap. And what happened to the gender gap is I believe seven states had the ability to codify abortion into their constitution or by law or referendum. And five of those states did, and then voted for Republicans. So you had this division on this whole idea of gender. And I think something is really important, and I need to go back in past elections to find out if this has ever happened before. But Democratic senatorial candidates were outperforming their presidential candidate. The literature talks about presidential coattails, where the presidential candidate pulls other people across the finish line. And in multiple states, you are seeing the opposite. So think about Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin. Last time I checked the numbers, she was up by about 30,000 votes. Trump won by 30,000 votes. In Michigan, it looks like Slotkin, the Democrat, versus Rogers, the Republican, it looks like she's going to win Michigan, the senatorial race, but she overperformed VP Harris. Pennsylvania, once all the votes get tabulated from Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, it looks like Bob Casey, the Democratic incumbent, is going to win, where the GOP McCormick is going to lose. Again, the Democratic senatorial candidates are outperforming Harris. And then you look at the two losses on the senatorial side, Tester in Montana and Sherrod Brown in Ohio. So when we talk about demographics, we really do have to think about that it's candidates matter, yes, but also intersectional candidates. VP Harris, America chose a white man with a troubled record. I'm sure we'll get into policies and those issues, but this whole idea of who Harris represented might be too much for the American public. And then in addition to turning to the right, like this hard, this is not a new shift. This is now solidifying that this country is a conservative, right-leaning country, and the policies, Even if half of the policies that Trump spoke about come true, we will definitely be seeing a remaking of the role of government.
The voice that you just heard was of Dr. Keisha Middlemass. She's associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Howard University. She's joined by Dr. Jasmine Carrera-Smith, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at George Washington University. And their third colleague in this conversation is Dr. Clarence Lussain, professor of political science and director of international affairs program at Howard University. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, focus on the topic and the guests as we talk about the 2024 post-election roundup. Again, thank you all for being here and at this juncture too, which is what I don't usually do, but it's always been inferred in the show. I mentioned the organizational affiliations only as for purposes of identification. I would remind listeners that the views expressed here are solely our own. Dr. Middlemass, you started us down that road of the down ticket, and I appreciate that all three of you push us beyond mere conventions. Let me cluster a couple of questions, and then you and your colleagues can speak forth. The split ticket behavior is something you described just now, that American voters, at least by the media massage, are split ticket voters. Local politics matters and is somehow extended into national politics and vice versa. Again, the fourth estate, my colleagues, sometimes we don't do a good job of that, but it seems to be something we love to describe that's at play. And I think I'll just tip into this subject, but I'll kind of leave it alone. I'll leave it up to you all. The party playbook, how does it engage marginalized demographics? You mentioned Senator Tester, pardon me, losing in Montana the First Nations Native vote would have been a factor of some sort in his campaign. We mentioned Michigan and the fact that Arab Americans were pushed and maintained their own particular positions given what's going on in Gaza and elsewhere around the world, and so on and so forth. As somebody who tries to practice some form of journalism, I grow very wary about the commentary that we offer about who didn't show up, who didn't vote, and why. And often it's couched in civility, but it's blaming usually voters that are pretty active, inclusive of their demographics. So I've gotten us started. I'll hush up now. Did you want to extend or respond to any of that, Dr. Middlemass?
Thank you so much. So I would like to broaden it out from the demographics and think about voter suppression, that there are these calls in the media and, you know, we're still early looking at the results, but this whole idea of we had record registration and yet we've got fewer votes tabulated and fewer votes than 2020 and 2016 total overall. So where are those missing votes? Are these the absentee ballots that were sent, that were mailed out or never received from voters in these swing states? I've done, you know, informal polling, but I know students at Howard, but students that were anxious about where's their ballot, and they would call and they would email and they would make efforts to like, where's my ballot? And it hasn't arrived. So then they made, if they had the financial wherewithal, they made plans to go travel and do same day registration if their state allowed it. And this whole idea of those that then mailed their ballot, and I've seen a lot of anecdotal evidence of this in the media broadly construed. So this is not just social media, but mainstream media too, talking about people have mailed their ballots, but it has not been received, or it's been received but not counted. And so I'm wondering, we have this one message about, oh, record number of registration, these are likely voters, but the numbers of who voted, there's a disconnect there, and I don't understand where it is. But to your point about Native Americans and outreach, I'm not sure if the Harris-Walz campaign could have done anything else for outreach. Now, how do they engage in outreach may be questionable, but this whole idea of having a targeted message matters, but also having the message of you matter not because of your racial, ethnic, religious identity, but you matter because you're a voter. I think the Democratic Party will have to start thinking in different terms of how they do that engagement.
Dr. Smith, particularly since we identified you about people deciding to be active and voting in primary elections, certainly you would have something more to say about all this.
Yeah, I mean, so this was a weird primary, right? We had a primary in which Joe Biden ran as the incumbent at the beginning of 2024. And then we all know the story, right? In the summer, after a not so good debate performance, he was kind of pushed out of and then chose to drop out of the general election race, right? And that's when we have Kamala Harris as the candidate, and that's when we've seen her have this shortened campaign season, right? And so what my work that talks about the intersection of how Black voters in particular, but in comparison to other racial and ethnic groups, right, how they behave at the primary election stage and how they're thinking about what's going to happen at the general election stage, it's a different story in this election because it was just, for lack of a better word, a weird election, right? A weird primary and a weird general election. And that changes the way that Kamala Harris ran her campaign, right? I tend to agree with Dr. Middlemass that I think, and the shortened time that she had, she did run a pretty great campaign, but it was segmented, it was shortened, right? Part of her campaign was telling the voters who she was, right? For those that didn't really have much of an awareness of her. Part of her campaign was drawing out these policies. And again, this really shortened framework, right? She just announced the opportunity for Black, economic opportunity agenda for Black men plan in the last 2 or 3 weeks, right, of her general election campaign. And so while she was doing a great job to say what she was going to do if she was elected president, it was just this shortened time to get to know her and get to know her campaign. And so I think there will be questions about how that ended up affecting this election in 2024.
Dr. Smith, thank you for those remarks. I'm going to turn to your colleague, Dr. Lusain, for a second, and hopefully I can take the bridge that you offer. So what bothers me in the pretense of facilitating discussions as a journalist is this. It seems our media world is occupied by polls. The soundbite from the voter with a lack of contextualization or analysis. So for instance, on the economy, whether you like the policies or not, the present administration has been very active with economic programs, yet the presentation from the Fourth Estate, my group, is someone saying, I feel more secure about the economy with person X or person Y, or in this race, it affects me this way. Dr. Lusain, unfair to you, but before we go to our break, can you speak to any of this about kind of this sense of public discussion, this sense of mutual responsibility between media and the voter?
So let me take a little bit of a different assertion approach here.
Thanks.
So I think what we're witnessing is the end of a Democratic Party era. The party of Pelosi, Biden, Claiborne, the Obamas, maybe even Harris, it's over. It is, the party as it's constructed now is insufficiently capable of addressing the far right. For example, much of the campaign, as we all know, was Donald Trump and others making broad racist kinds of statements. The party decided it would not respond to that, that it would dangle in front of the voters all they did on the economy, all they did on this, these rights and those rights. That is not how you fight this battle. And so going forward, it's going to require, I think, a party that has a very different kind of agility to go after these kinds of issues. We saw, for example, I think there was a mistake made around how the Gaza situation was dealt with. If you look at Dearborn, the mayor was very pro-Harris. The mayor of Hamtramck was not, but the mayor of Dearborn was. The results were 47% of people in Dearborn voted for Donald Trump. 22% voted for Jill Stein. The Democrats were completely wiped out, even though it had the more rational, and certainly if you look down the road at what's coming, it made the most sense. So I think the party is at a turning point, and it, and as Dr. Middlemass says, whatever autopsy that that they do, they're going to have to really understand we're in a completely different era. The far right operates very differently than the far right in the past. It will be inclusive of women, of people of color. There will be trans people. There will be LGBTQ people. There will be immigrants who will be fronted by the far right as they move to consolidate their agenda.
And upon that dramatic remark, forgive the false histrionics, Dr. Lusain, we come to our midpoint of the show, and I have to do due diligence, do some housework here, and just say to the listeners, won't you stay with us? You're listening to We the People right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. WPFWFM.org. Thanking you for supporting this Pacifica Foundation radio station for more than 47 years. by your financial support and your social connectivity. In service to you, we bring you PSAs at the midpoint of our show. I ask that you stay with us as we have a roundup post-election discussion with our fellow political scientists, who I'll re-identify after the break. Thank you. Won't you stay with us?
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. It is such an exciting day. We ask you to go to the phone. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Or you can call 1-800-222-9739. That's 1-800-222-9739. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW. And it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show. You and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. If you call now 1-800-222-9739, that's 1-800-222-WPFW, or go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire, because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, 1-800-222-WPFW, or go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
And welcome back to 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, David Whetstone. The hour is We the People. We're doing a post-election roundup. And I just want to, again, add my voice of thanks, joining 80-plus different programmers who bring you jazz and justice. I'm going to do the lineup a little bit early at this point in the show and remind you and welcome a new colleague. At 5 p.m. today, Tony Browder introduces a new program, The Browder Files. Before Tony, there's Sophie's Parlor from 3 to 5, Music and Culture by Women but for Everyone. At 2 p.m. Eastern, Shay Wanana with Zen El Amin discusses Middle Eastern affairs. My good colleague Moisa Mutali and his producer and co-host James Pope bring you Africa Now, broadcast terrestrially at 1 p.m. Eastern. African descended people discussed about not only on the continent but throughout the diaspora, discussing their engagements of politics, history, environment, and culture. Last but not least, every noon hour during the week, we ask you not to forget the blues. Don't forget the blues. Our Wednesday host is Clarence the Bluesman Turner. All that is brought to you because you, the listener, again, choose to support us in our entirety, and I thank you. Dr. Clarence Lusain, Dr. Keisha Middlemoss, Dr. Jasmine Carrera-Smith, all political scientists, were discussing what has gone on the day after national elections. I don't know where to get started, but Dr. Lusain knows me very well, especially when I do public speaking. I'm always talking down ballot. There's a drama here. It seems the pronosticators have also predicted that the U.S. Senate will be Republican controlled. That is very likely, even as there's still tallies coming in on some very close races that are in swing states. The U.S. House of Representatives remains in question. I think I've got this right. Because you're winnowing things down into on the district level, some of those vote tallies are still due. So I'll ask this generalized question. How do we think about how people vote down ballot or across issues I'm going to confess that I believe the media really, again, reduces the engagement of the voter to sound bites. You, as political scientists, probably have the means to think otherwise. Can you explain this to us at least a little bit? Who would like to start?
Yeah, I can take this question. I think there's a couple of things here, right? So we still have a question of the control of the House, right? And this has implications for the way in which Donald Trump can run his presidency, right? So if control of the House goes to the Republican Party, and the Republican Party holds both the House and Senate and the Oval Office, right? This gives a lot of leeway for Donald Trump to pass the policies that he wants to, right? And so his campaign was really run on the issue of immigration. And so this might be one way in which we see this impact, right? He can focus his immigration policy through executive order, but also if the Republican Party controls the House and the Senate, then there's measure to pass law in this regard, right? But so that is still up for grabs. And so we're going to be wondering what that is like, right? But the other question is this issue that has been brought up in this hour, which is the reality that many voters are split ticketing their votes, which is, in a way, thinking about the political science literature, quite bizarre. We typically tend to think that voters, for the most part, vote straight ticket, right? And we also tend to think in this era of strong partisanship, right, of people really having emotional and affective attachments to their party. And also in this era of polarization, where if you're ideologically conservative, then you're going to be Republican. If you're ideologically liberal, you're going to be Democrat, right? So given all of this context, it's strange, right, that many voters are split ticketing. And we see this in a couple of ways. We've mentioned, you know, these Senate contests where Democrats have won, but have also voted for Trump for the presidency. But on the other hand, we have cases like North Carolina, where Josh Stein, the Democrat, won.
The governorship.
North Carolina.
The governorship.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. governorship in North Carolina went for Donald Trump. Part of this is because the Republican gubernatorial candidate, Mark Robinson, was a bad candidate, right? And so that can explain this, right? But we see this in lots of ballot measures too, right? That many states that had, for example, abortion access on referenda on the ballot, these measures passed in many states, but they also voted for Donald Trump. And so it is this question of what's going on. And I think it's going to take, again, a couple of days and a couple of weeks to really understand what is behind the motive of these voters as they're split ticketing.
I sense, and perhaps Dr. Middlemass, I could ask you, but the question is to all three of you. Both as an average person, but also as a journalist, I'm always thinking this word that you mentioned, Dr. Smith, affect, how people really believe that there's a direct connection with the person they're voting for, with services received or with an environment that's controlled, whether you're thinking, you know, housing, crime, jobs, whatever. There's always this, and I'm trying to resist this, but I'm going to just go ahead and say it. It's not just the facts, it's the affect, that people really are voting with this belief that somehow an elected official has immediate control, immediate response, and dare I say immediate responsibility for whatever topic. Certainly economics and inflation have been discussed as such. How would you all respond to that?
I would actually like to broaden this, and it's not just the affect, but it's the emotional response. So we think about actors, or we, in the literature, political scientists talk about rational actors as voters. And I want to say that Black voters are rational actors. They will vote for the best candidate for the larger Black community and other marginalized communities, and do so time and time and time and time again. Other voters, other voting groups, may have their preferences of who their best candidate is, but they also then will act in what I would consider a non-rational way because of emotions. So this gets to one example, for instance. I think with polling, people lie. And the socially acceptable response to pollsters, I'm voting for Kamala Harris. Because otherwise, they would have to say, well, I'm voting for the man who's been convicted of sexual assault, who has these 91 various court cases, you all know, has court cases, who is vulgar, who is rude, who is demeaning. I'm going to vote for that guy. So people are, I think, literally having the rational response as to what is socially acceptable to respond to a pollster. I'm voting for Kamala. I'm voting for the Harris-Walz campaign, because it would be unacceptable to say I am voting for Trump in many, many, you know, instances. So I think this whole idea of an emotional response, that we have to actually now interrogate this idea of America is a racist country. America is a racist state. This whole idea of misogyny. And VP Harris represented the two biggest things in this country that a lot of people are not prepared for. Having a woman in the White House.
Not willing to deal with it. Yeah.
Not willing to deal with it. Not willing to talk about it. You think about the patriarchy of white women voting continuously for men who they would not want their daughters to date, but it's acceptable to vote for them because that's their feeling. Oh, a man should be in the White House. And so I know we're going to have multiple conversations for the rest of this year, and I bet political science conferences are just going to have so many panels on the 2024 election, I'm going to like check out. But we have to just deal with the reality is patriarchy, misogyny, racism, and sexism is real in this country. And it is evidence, in my opinion, in these vote turnout, in the vote results.
And not to be anticlimactic, but I just want to add the journalistic out. We'll walk up in front of somebody, ask them a question about who they support or what they support. And they'll say, I don't like the behavior, but I like the policy. And there's never any follow-up question. Just wanted to get that in there. But I'm going to defer.
Sorry, I'm going to be slightly rude, David. People complaining that VP Harris laughs too much. When was joy and this idea that you can be joyful doing your job?
Criminal.
A demeaning characterization. Thank you.
All right. Dr. Lusain, I wanted to give you an opportunity to gauge all of this.
So first of all, let me say I'm disturbed that Mark Robinson got 40% of the vote in North Carolina. That is just shocking. So there was split ticket going on, but 40% for the Black Nazi, right? But in a broader sense,
By the way, you're not being frivolous. There is a statement associated with him. I just want to make that clear to listeners.
So sometimes we say that people don't vote for who a person is, they vote for who that person represents. And so often, and picking up on Dr. Middlemass's, comments, people have seen Donald Trump, as has been said, he hates the people they hate. So all of the convictions and the sexual assault and all of that stuff is background, because they need someone, they want someone who's going to represent what they think will take the country. And what I think, again, we're going to be grappling with is how that broadens itself beyond kind of the white nationalist core, but to a broader set of folks in this country who are leaning into authoritarianism and are willing to accept political violence. They're willing to accept democratic decline, all of these different ways in which the country shifts. And what we're going to see that Dr. Smith was talking about with a new Congress, even if the Democrats somehow hold on to the House, it's going to be much further to the right. And there will not be 10 Republicans who are going to vote for impeachment on Donald Trump, no matter what the hell he does. And they are absolutely clear that they're going to push through the agenda of Moms for Liberty, American Legal,
Alec.
America First Legal. All of these far right entities that came in the wake of Trump leaving office. They aren't going anywhere. They are going to be the front lines for the administration beyond Congress, beyond the White House. And Proud Boys, they're still around. You know, there's some other militia groups. They all are, I looked at some of their websites. They all are jumping for joy, right? They're like, we're back. They're planning welcome home parties for people who were arrested for January 6th. You know, this is where we're at, less than 24 hours after the election. So, you know, we're going to really have to dig in, and we're going to really have to be prepared for, some unforeseen politics that we have not, we thought kind of weren't here, but are actually moving to the center.
You know, I just like to add that what happens with what you describe comes to fruition when climate change is upon us, when we have to practice some sense of international cooperation, when a natural disaster, probably from climate change, ravages a section of the country, when we honestly have to encourage people to think beyond urban and rural divides or think in one particular pocket of the country versus another. What really happens, and I'm saying this in regard to not only the focus, I just had Bill Ayers on last week, and one of the things he says, particularly of the left and progressives, is this intense focus on the seat of power and thinking that's the means to get things done, as opposed to putting your focus and energy upon different ways of doing things, different ways of challenging oppression. So instead of prattling, all I'm saying is with the authoritarianism and racism you describe, what happens when we have to really deal with some serious problems and we do have to work together?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think of this in two ways. So one of the other implications of a Trump presidency is what happens with the Supreme Court, right? So he may have more opportunity and probably will, right, to appoint more Supreme Court justices. And then we also have to think about, it's not just the Supreme Court, but the federal judiciary, right, that he also can support judges or appoint judges there, right? And so these are some of the, it isn't just the presidency, right? There's all these down ballot measures, the House and the Senate, and also the judiciary that this has impacts on, right? But so what do we do with this then? So one question that we can think about is, the Harris campaign is really running on the, was running on this message of democracy really matters, which I think is right. And so the focus here, especially when you're running a campaign, right, is on turning out to vote and voting for Harris. But this is just one part of combating white supremacy, combating white nationalism, and getting the things that Black people and people of color want, right? So organizing is really important. Organizing at the local level and the state is really important. passing ballot measures in each state that are beneficial to the Black community and other communities of interest is really important, right? And so this is where we have to not only shift our focus, but moving forward, those in the Democratic Party need to think about these traditional ways of participating in politics, but also non-traditional ways of participating in politics to get the things that we want done.
And Dr. Middlemass, I see you want to extend this further. Go ahead, please.
Thank you so much. So Dr. Smith brought up a great point about the solidification of the Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court will, however many people will decide to retire or leave the court for whatever reasons, but there won't be any hearings on the ethics of Supreme Court justices, which could have happened underneath a Harris administration and a Democratic Senate. You think about DOJ oversight of policing practices, DOJ and its civil rights division and voter suppression and investigations, and they probably will be cut. Funding for FEMA to respond to climate change, natural disasters might be cut. You think about DACA and whether or not that will be extended. You think about gun control. So there's all these policy issues that are now literally on the chopping block because of the Republican control of the United States Senate, White House, and we don't know about the House of Representatives.
Where does that leave us, particularly with the show ending in less than two minutes? Let me go ahead and... no, go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, go ahead, Dr. Lee Singh.
Well, also, to be really selfish here, Washington, D.C. is also on the chopping block. D.C. is low-hanging fruit, and it would be an easy little symbolic game to just strip away D.C. statehood. So all of, you know, so a whole range of things, much of which is in Project 2025, is the agenda. When Ronald Reagan was elected and the Heritage Foundation put out Mandate for Change, whatever the thing was called, they actually tried to implement it. They're going to try to do this. So we should not have any illusions about the storm that's coming.
We can squeeze out a minute. Is there anything else anyone wants to say? Well, that being said, can I thank you all, Dr. Jasmine Carrera-Smith, Dr. Keisha Middlemass, and Dr. Clarence Lusane. Thank you for at least giving us a full and robust roundup the day after the elections. I'm David Whetstone, and I thank you, the listeners, for joining and supporting the various programmers who bring you Jazz and Justice in an attempt that we build a better world one broadcast at a time right here at WPFW 89.3 FM. WPFWFM.org. My thanks to Mike Nasella, our engineer, to the News and Public Affairs Program of WPFW, and to you, the listener, for choosing to stay with us in this hour and beyond and supporting the station. All the best to you. All hope, peace, and power to you in this moment and beyond. Thank you. Take care.
Stephon Lockridge, 15-year-old grandson of William O. Lockridge, awarded community activist, school board member, and teacher who became an ancestor in 2011. On Saturday, November 9th, 7 p.m., the William O. Lockridge Community Foundation presents the 14th annual Dancing with the Scholars. The event, featuring a dance competition with voice 7 and 8 high school students and elected officials, happens at The Art on 1901 Mississippi Avenue, Southeast D.C. The Lockridge Foundation keeps my grandfather's legacy alive by providing college scholarships to Ward 7 and 8 high school students and biannually taking the students to Africa. For details, please visit William Lockridge Community Foundation.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Pacifica Radio, I'm Scott Baba. Former President Donald Trump was elected as the 47th President of the United States on Wednesday. He is the first person convicted of a felony to win the White House and the first former president to regain power since 1892. Julie Walker reports.
Donald Trump has been elected the 47th president of the United States, an extraordinary comeback for a former president who refused to accept defeat 4 years ago, sparked a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, was convicted of felony charges, and survived two assassination attempts.
We overcame obstacles that nobody thought possible, and it is now clear that we've achieved the most incredible political thing. Look what happened. Is this crazy?
With a win in Wisconsin, Trump cleared the 270 electoral votes needed to clinch the presidency.
This will truly be the golden age of America.
The victory validates his bare-knuckle approach to politics. Now he says it's time to heal.
Every citizen, I will fight for you, for your family, and your future.
I'm Julie Walker.
Meanwhile, Republicans have taken the Senate majority and are fighting to keep control of the House. A unified Republican grip on Washington would set the course for President-elect Donald Trump's agenda. Jennifer King reports.
Republicans have won a majority in the U.S. Senate for the first time in 4 years, clearing a legislative path for a conservative agenda. In West Virginia, Governor Jim Justice scored an early win, filling the seat that was held by Joe Manchin. Then Cleveland businessman Bernie Moreno beat longtime incumbent Sherrod Brown in Ohio.
We're tired of leaders that think we're garbage.
Each Republican incumbent reelected helped cement the gains. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas credited his win in part to a surge in support from Latino voters in counties on the U.S.-Mexico border.
We're going to have a Republican Senate next year.
In Nebraska, Senator Deb Fischer fended off a challenge from an independent newcomer. Senator Rick Scott of Florida says Washington is ready for a change.
Our work is not done.
As Mitch McConnell of Kentucky prepares to step down from the leadership position.
We need the Republican Party to start solving the problems of this country, and we have a significant number of problems.
Audio courtesy KTRK and WPLG-TV. Jennifer King, Washington.
Abortion rights advocates lost on Florida, Nebraska, and South Dakota ballot measures, but prevailed in seven other states, including Missouri, where an amendment clears the way to undo one of the nation's strictest bans. By rejecting adding abortion rights to their state constitution, Florida voters kept a ban on abortion after the first 6 weeks of pregnancy in place. Arizona, Colorado, Maryland, Montana, and Nevada voters adopted such measures, and New Yorkers passed an amendment to bar discrimination on the basis of pregnancy outcomes. Lebanon authorities say that over two dozen people were killed after the Israeli military struck an apartment building last night. Charles de Ledesma reports.
Lebanon's Civil Defense Service says they've pulled around 30 bodies and remains out of the rubble after an Israeli strike hit an apartment building in Baja, an area that's not been regularly targeted by Israeli military operations. As excavators work at the site, resident Musa Zaran, who was at home with his wife and son when the building was hit, tells the AP, "Something pulled me hard, and then the explosion happened. I couldn't see because of the smoke." He goes on, he had begun to cry and dig through the rubble until he found his wife and son, alive but injured, and pulled them out one after the other, and they were taken to hospital. Other residents moved the Zaran family belongings out of the wrecked building. A civil defense official says it's unclear how many survivors or bodies are still trapped under the rubble. There's been no statement from the Israeli military on the strike. It's not immediately clear what the intended target was. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Hurricane Rafael strengthened into a Category 2 storm just hours before it was forecast to make landfall today in western Cuba. It's another stroke of bad news for Cuba. The Caribbean country has been struggling with blackouts while recovering from another hurricane 2 weeks ago that killed at least six people in the eastern part of the island. According to the National Hurricane